Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santaferadiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later in the program, we're going to be talking about the new Santa Fe Higher Education Center. That's Santa Fe Community College and other institutions. I'd like now to welcome to the program Keith McHenry. He is one of the co-founders of the Food Not Bombs movement, and he just happens to be passing through Santa Fe and here in the cafe, so we thought we'd just talk for a few minutes. Welcome.
Thanks for having me. It is funny that we'd be here at the same time.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, so you are co-founder of Food Not Bombs. First of all, what's that all about?
Well, Food Not Bombs started 31 years ago in Boston, and it started because a number of us, including myself, worked in the food industry, and I was discarding lots of produce at an organic grocery store called Bread and Circus. And so we realized that we could combine the sharing of free food to the poor and to the hungry, and also do street theater, hand out free vegetarian vegan meals on the streets, and try to reach the mainstream community with these ideas. And at that time, the war in El Salvador was huge, things like that. Also, Reagan was doing a big intercontinental ballistic missile, nuclear missile buildup in the Cold War. So from that, originally it was just the 8 or 9 of us in Boston, and we did take food to protests in New York and Washington, D.C. But in 1988, I moved to San Francisco, where we got arrested. And because we got arrested...
What did you get arrested for?
They arrested us for not having a permit. It turned out no permit existed. And after 94 arrests, they ended up, the mayor made up a permit concept and gave it to us. But those arrests inspired people from other cities, mostly in the United States, but also Canada and Europe, to start their own organizations. And so out of that, it became like a formal association. We're all volunteer, no paid staff. The food is always free, vegan or vegetarian, and free to anyone without restriction. And we're dedicated to nonviolent direct action. So we don't perceive ourselves as a charity. We're trying to encourage the public to see that things like military spending could be diverted to healthcare, education, social services, and that we could create a world where no one has to stand in line to get food at a soup kitchen, and that everybody really deserves to be able to buy and have their own food and prepare it how they want to, and to be as healthy as they desire without having to go through all these like hoops of like, you know, filling out forms to be, you know, get your food through food bank. You know, not that, I mean, we have to do that kind of stuff now, people in America, but we perceive of a future where everyone has the nutritious food that they desire.
One of the things that's interesting and just weird about Food Not Bombs is that in the United States now, it seems that somebody is always getting arrested for serving food to the homeless. And there's a lot of homeless people, and there's a lot of extra food, and yet the authorities don't seem to want you to put those together.
Yeah, it's been a problem. Even in even here in New Mexico, there's been these waves of threats by the city officials to stop us, and we were fined like $500 a meal for a while, both in Albuquerque and Taos. It turned out it was a military contractor who saw us. He was concerned that our name said food and not bombs, and he went to the University of New Mexico. They didn't know what to do, so they sent him to the environmental health people, which also did not know what to do other than to fine us. And we never could meet with environmental health, and eventually, actually, the governor, last governor, Bill Richardson, just put a stop to the whole problem. But that's been a problem throughout many areas, including now in Orlando, where it's a combination of Lockheed is pressuring the city officials to shut us down, but it's also other large financial institutions in Orlando, like Disney World, who are concerned that tourists will see low-income people, and therefore they will feel somehow discouraged from paying the ticket prices to the different attractions in the Orlando area. And also because homelessness is growing so rapidly right now with foreclosure crisis and the failed economy, the pressure on all the cities in Florida is really increasing. So after Orlando made its law, and it lost in federal court, it eventually won an appeal in the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals, allowing them to restrict us to two meals a year per park. The other cities in Florida, who are also pressured by so much visible homelessness, decide they would make similar laws. So we have Sarasota, Fort Myers, Fort Lauderdale, Tallahassee. All these cities are investigating ways of making laws to limit the distribution of free food to the hungry. And San Francisco...
It's a form of madness in a so-called Christian nation.
And particularly, these people are the most Christian of Christian people. That's what's really outrageous.
Or they say they are.
They say they are. And it is really... It's astounding. And the level of repression, for instance, in San Francisco... We took videos of every one of our arrests, and we had so much video. We made a video called Food Not Bomb's Greatest Hits because we were being violently beaten by the police for sharing food. I've had several surgeries. You can still see my eyes watering from being beaten by the police in 1993. I was also taken to a police intelligence office three times where they ripped my clothes off of me, lifted me by my arms and legs until my tendons and ligaments ripped, and they put me in what they call a stress position box.
That's torture.
Yeah, that's the same box that was used in Bagram Air Base and in Abu Ghraib. Some of the people involved have been trained at the same school as the people at Abu Ghraib at the Military School of Information Extraction in Fort Huachuca, Arizona. And this all for the purpose of trying to stop us from sharing free food. And I just did like 17 days in Orlando, Florida in July.
17 days in jail.
In jail, just for sharing food. I was not. They would not allow me to make phone calls out of there. They blocked my ability to make any outgoing phone calls. It was very hard to even get letters in and out. And so I was out of communications completely for over 2 weeks. And the people on the outside could not even figure out what was happening. I'm now facing a year in jail from behind this. I was accused of aiding and abetting a criminal activity of feeding more than 24 people more than twice in 12 months. And I was accused of trespassing by standing on the side, wrong side of a little line on the sidewalk. There's now 28 of us besides myself. I'm 29th person that's facing these kind of charges in Orlando. And people in other cities are now looking, even Houston, as far as Houston, which is apparently that city government has observed what's gone on in Orlando, and they're considering making a law limiting the sharing of food, even in Texas. So this is starting to spread in the southern United States, and it's because of the number of homeless people that are starting to appear in the southern United States because they can't survive the harsh winters of the north.
To add insult to injury, when you got out of this jail... Which, I mean, you hadn't been convicted of a crime. I mean, the jail, you know, you're accused of something. They arrest you. They put you in jail. They charged you rent.
Yeah, that's an amazing thing about the Florida jail system. They charge you rent. They also charged me. I was jailed twice, so I was charged total of $10 for my little name tag. You're also charged for your medication. I have fibromyalgia, so they gave me, I made the mistake of asking for Motrin and got Motrin, and so they charge you for that. In the end, I had a total of $350 in charges and court costs, in transportation charges. And there are homeless people who are now in jail in Florida because they couldn't pay their original rent for earlier incarcerations and are now being held because they can't, and now incurring even more rent as a result. And so I've met people that owe thousands of dollars and yet they live on the streets. Obviously they'd rent an apartment and try to avoid being criminalized by being homeless if they could, yet the courts they're also the Orange County Department of Corrections and other, even the state of Florida is going to privatize a number of prisons. And they are have proposed to reduce the food from 3 times a day, which is almost no food at all anyway. I was hungry. I fasted at the beginning because I thought I would get out like in a short while, and I'm a vegetarian, so there was nothing there for me to really eat. But at the end, I ended up like eating a little bit what I could out of their meals, and everybody complained. There was just not enough food to maintain a human body, barely at all. And
Even if you ate everything
on your plate, everybody was done eating within like 4 minutes of sitting down because there was just no food there. And now they're going to get rid of one of the 3 meals. It's pretty incredible. And I don't think most Americans realize that there are millions of Americans in these jails under these really harsh conditions. And I met people who lost their families as a result because their families couldn't get contact with them. Eventually they gave up and they never knew when their husband would ever be freed, and so they just moved on to a new husband, new family, because what could they do? There was no expectation of their family members being freed.
We're talking to Keith McHenry, co-founder of the Food Not Bombs movement. So how big is this movement? Who's in it? What's it like?
Well, the Food Not Bombs movement is active in at least 1,000 cities of the world. We're all volunteer, and majority of the people are really college-age people and young adults. But we have high school clubs as well, and we and high school volunteers. And we do have people that one of the very active volunteer for 20 years was Eric Weinberger. He was actually one of the people that helped organize the protest in Chicago during the Democratic Convention. And he was very close to Martin Luther King, and he did several years in jail on the freedom marches working in Alabama and Mississippi. And so we have people from that background that who have been doing civil rights work for many years. He recently passed away. But all the way to very, very young people in high school and elementary school. It's active in 1,000 cities. Some of the more active cities are Moscow, Russia, Portland, Oregon, San Francisco. At one point, San Francisco shared food twice a day, 7 days a week. But that's rare that we're that organized. We actually took over Mother Teresa's Sisters of Charity's location when she agreed to leave the area when the city was trying to drive the homeless out of sight. And then we've also done things like we fed the 9/11 rescue workers at the Staten Island Ferry and at 9/11 at the Ground Zero in Manhattan. We fed for 8 months the people that survived Katrina. We had very active kitchens in the Ninth Ward and in the French Quarter and the Financial District of New Orleans. The Red Cross gave out our number as the official number for food. And we had kitchens in a total of 20 cities for 8 months in Louisiana, Mississippi, and Alabama. I was on the phone every week to 211, which was the emergency relief people. I talked to the City Council of New Orleans frequently about how to handle this food crisis. And people are kind of shocked that for that long, it was an all-volunteer group. The Red Cross was not allowed to go down there, and that we provided vegan and vegetarian meals to the survivors of Katrina. We've also fed the Orange Revolution in the Ukraine for 100 days. We fed a 600-day farm workers strike in Bosnia-Herzegovina Park in Sarajevo. We've provided food at many of the anti-globalization protests, like the one in Seattle in 99, but also Cancun and Genoa, Italy, and all over the world, basically. And we provide a lot of food for protests against environmental destruction. We're very tight with Aboriginal people in Australia, as well as Native community here in the United States, where we have provided food to the Dan Ranch, Shoshone Nation. In Nevada, we've been active in the Four Corners with both the traditional Hopi and Diné people. And so we've been active not only with the weekly and often daily meals of just the poor and hungry in the United States, but we have supported all kinds of other human rights and animal rights activities. One of the most miraculous things I saw was in Slovakia, the Food Not Bombs chapters there, after Czechoslovakia divided. The first big project they did was start animal rescue shelters in 20 cities of Slovakia. But we've also done planted olive trees in the West Bank. We feed the Palestinian workers at the checkpoints coming into Israel. We started a program called Anarchists Against the Wall, where we Jewish people from Israel will march to the wall from the Palestinian side and cut holes through the wall to let the Palestinian farmers get to their fields. And we also have chapters in Africa. All the way, Argentina was very big when that economy crashed. Fruit Bombs did a ton of stuff down there. And so we're basically in every corner of the world. A really exciting thing is our involvement in Reykjavik, Iceland, where the meal every week on Saturday became a march to Parliament building. And it became known that Fruit Bombs was one of the core organizations that helped overthrow that government because of their bad investment policies and their bad banking policies in the U.S. housing market.
Where do you get the food?
The food is discarded. Contrary to popular belief, we don't really dumpster dive the food. Some people think we do that. But the reality is that we have always talked to produce workers and bakers and produce warehouses, the workers at produce warehouses, and we set up a schedule where we recover the food that they cannot sell. And that way we get much larger amounts of food, much better quality, and it stays refrigerated till the last moment before we pick it up. We do concerts, and I speak at colleges and universities to raise money. And with the honorariums, I've done things like buy pots and pans. I bought a van for the Food Not Bombs movement in Nigeria and made several trips to Nigeria to help Food Not Bombs get started there. But also I buy bulk food through United Natural Foods, which the limit is 500, but I buy like lots and lots of rice and beans and oats. And so what is not recovered is purchased in bulk through them, and it's distributed amongst chapters so that they have like some extra food that they to add, because we don't always get discarded rice. We don't always get discarded beans.
This is a life commitment for you, obviously. You've been doing it for a long time. What is your motivation to keep going?
Well, my motivation is, first of all, the actual activity of collecting the food is remarkable. To see how much food is discarded and to know that it can actually be a benefit for people. The second thing is the actual sharing of the food is miraculous, because your experience of meeting all these people, and people would be surprised how many Americans have gone 4 or 5 days without eating, and the meal at Food Not Bombs is their first meal in maybe a week or something. And just the relationship you develop with these people that are coming to eat at Food Not Bombs. And then finally, the social situation always seems to be getting more and more crazy, with more and more budget cuts, with a diversion of money going more towards the military, and the homelessness and hunger becoming more and more dire. And so that motivates me to try to encourage the public through the means of Food Not Bombs, which to me, after all these years, seemed to be one of the more effective ways of building popular support for changing our priorities. And so to me, every time I read an article, like I just read one about like how food prices are going to double and the United Nations is freaking out, and Oxfam had another report, and you read those kinds of things, or you meet somebody who has just lost their home and they're now doubling up with their neighbors and things like that, any of those things will just like inspire me to like, oh no, I can't stop. I've got to keep doing it. So
Keith McHenry is co-founder of the Food Not Bombs movement, which is on the net at foodnotbombs.net. Now, you are about to release a book?
Correct. I have a book that I wrote a book years ago in 1992, and it was updated a couple of times, called Food Not Bombs, How to Feed the Hungry and Build Community. So I've sold 8,000 copies in English, and I've sold 3,000 in Italian, another 3,000 in Spanish, and some in Croatian and Polish and Russian. So my publisher, when he announced that he only had 90 copies left of the English edition, said you should rewrite the book. So the title's slightly changed. I've got two books happening. The first one I'm going to release would be the Food Not Bombs book, How to Share Food with the Hungry and Cultivate Community. and it'll be very similar to the first book, although it will have recipes or be more universal. I have vegan recipes for 100, but this time also for 6. And the measurements will not be limited to the United States, but it'll be measurements that people in other continents can use. And then the second book is called the Food Not Bombs Story, and it'll be a very detailed history of Food Not Bombs over the past 30 years. And I think many people will be just surprised on reading that book. That I'm very far along with that. To find out all the things Food Not Bombs has done. And many people in the listening audience have probably been directly affected by Food Not Bombs but did not realize it and just assumed that it was just a group of kids at some corner that they happened to meet. But the reality is, we've been on the front lines of many, many social movements in the past 30 years, including the anti-racist movement in Russia, where we've had 4 volunteers stabbed to death by neo-Nazis. Neo-Nazis actually set off a time bomb at our St. Petersburg, Russia meal. Fortunately, we were about 10 minutes late, so no one was injured. But also all the stuff we've done in the Middle East that we've been involved in, and as well as things in New Zealand and many, many protests like this year we're organizing with the Organic Consumers Association on the millions against Monsanto. So we've been doing anti-genetically modified food work for decades. We've been connected to the slow foods movement in Europe for well over a decade, the anti-globalization movement, the punk movement. We've really been tight with punk bands for years, like MDC, Propagandhi, Avail. So anybody that's been in the hardcore punk movement in the 80s or late 70s up to now, Green Day, for instance, was, before they were famous and signed, was the Food Not Bombs cooks at East Bay Food Not Bombs. And they've been really tight and with us for decades. We haven't talked to them since they became famous much, but we've had like a lot of, we've tried to have culture and art and music and food and try it, and it being vegan and vegetarian, animal rights actions that we have done. We provide food for the sea shepherds when they land, come to port. Many of the so-called eco-terrorists and many ALF and ELF people that have been accused of terrorism turned out to be Food Not Bombs volunteers who were actually dedicated to nonviolence and had no involvement in any, even remotely, in terrorist activities, but were falsely accused, and in some cases, went to court, and in a few cases, gone to prison. So I'll have more about that in the second book, which should be out sometime in the spring. And the first book will come out hopefully in I'm sending it to the publisher in the next two weeks. I'm finishing the layout. I did all the illustrations for it myself. I collected all the photos. I'm a graphic designer by trade, so that's. I wanted to make sure I did the design myself and had all the photos connected to what I wanted them to be. And so that's what I'm doing right now.
Are you involved in growing food at all?
I do. I have, like many New Mexicans, I was hit by a drunk driver while driving, and I got the settlement from that. So I bought an acre of farmland in Taos, which I'm cultivating. But I've been I studied organic gardening at the School of Social Ecology in Plainfield, Vermont years ago, and my family had a farm in Cape Cod for much of my life, and so I've been doing organic gardening for many years, and I teach classes in that through a program that we call Food Not Lawns. And the Food Not Lawns movement has been taking over people's abandoned lots mostly, and we talk with the owners of those lots, and we're allowed to clean the soil and then cultivate it, and we teach the community how to do their own organic gardening. And so for years now, I've been teaching both how to, to make a healthy, fertile soil, and then how to actually put the seeds in, and then what to do about irrigation and water, and then weeding, and then cultivation and harvesting. And so a friend of mine, Heather Flores, has written a really fantastic book called Food Not Lawns. And her book actually really kicked off this whole movement. So many Food Not Bombs chapters not only do the collecting of the food and sharing it, but they start Food Not Lawns gardens. They will also start Bikes Not Bombs chapters, where we ask the community to give us old bike parts that they can't use. We make our own bikes, give them to low-income people. And then we also have the really, really free markets, where we collect free everything, and then one day a month or sometimes every week we'll give away free everything to people. And then we also have the Homes Not Jails movement, where we take over foreclosed, abandoned properties. We repair them with the help of the community, and we move homeless families into those buildings.
Keith McHenry, co-founder of Food Not Bombs, on the web at foodnotbombs.net. We hope to have you back on the air when your book comes out. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you so much, Mary Charlotte. That's so cool. Thanks for having me. That's
Thank
great.
You. Okay.
Wow, a celebrity. I got to meet a celebrity.
I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Sheila Ortego. She is president of Santa Fe Community College. Dr. Jim Fries is president of New Mexico Highlands University, and Dr. Robert Martin is president of the Institute of American Indian Arts. And we are here to talk about the Santa Fe Higher Education Center. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So the Santa Fe Higher Education Center, what is it? What's it all about?
It's really a collaboration of higher education institutions designed to make education, higher education, more affordable and accessible to local Santa Feans. So rather than starting a new institution or choosing one of the institutions in the state, Santa Fe Community College is partnering with several to allow students the broadest options for higher education here where they live.
By higher education, you mean college? You mean four-year college?
Yes, bachelor's degrees and beyond.
So is this Santa Fe Higher Education Center, is it a place?
It will be. Right now we're piloting on the campus of Santa Fe Community College, and we have UNM, Highlands, and IAIA all as partners. And so we offer the first 2 years of a college degree to
students.
At
the community college.
Yes, at a very affordable rate, as you know, and then they can choose which option to go on to beyond that for their third and fourth year and even master's programs.
So IAIA, what is the nature of the program right now?
Well, we have, we're going to be offering the general studies, and we call ours Indigenous Liberal Studies, and that is a general studies, but from that includes a unique perspective. That's an Indigenous perspective, and so we think that's going to be quite attractive to people here in Santa Fe. We've had a partnership with the community college for some years. We have articulation agreements for 2+2 in creative writing and museum studies. And we saw this as a logical next step. What we're trying to do is increase our enrollment, especially from people here in the community. And we're, of course, we're inviting them to come to our main campus, but we see the Higher Education Center as increasing the accessibility to our programs.
Now, IAIA offers, what degree does it offer at this point? Before the Higher Education Center? Yeah, at the school currently.
Well, we offer all the studio arts, new media arts, museum studies, creative writing, and Indigenous Liberal Studies, which is the general studies.
And what's the degree you get at the end?
You
a
get
BA?
A BA, BFA.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
So it's already a four-year institution?
Yes, it is.
Okay.
That's why we're able to offer the last 2 years of the program at the Higher Education Center.
Now, IAIA is also open to non-native students.
Yes, and we've been that way for about 25 years, and we're hoping to increase our enrollment among the non-natives here in the community. But it's still, our mission remains the same, to empower creativity and leadership in Native arts and cultures. But we offer our coursework, and you get that Native perspective.
I went there for 2 semesters a long time ago, and it was still on the College of Santa Fe campus, and what a wonderful experience.
You should come and visit our campus now. We've got 10 buildings, and we just opened 2 in the last year. And so.
Yeah, it's an incredible campus down now past the Santa Fe Community College. Now, Highlands University is also a four-year state college.
That's right. We're four-year and also offer a large number of master's degree programs.
And when you talk about this collaboration, are you, Sheila Ortego, talking about having for the BA that will be available and will be available here in Santa Fe, every possible major or a limited number of majors?
No, we've actually targeted the ones that are most needed for our local workforce. So things like social work, education, business. We've done extensive needs assessments and studies in terms of interest, our local interest, and also our workforce needs. That is a priority of our state right now, and we're on board with that. We know that we need to develop our workforce and do a lot of economic development. So fortunately, Highlands University is very strong in all of those areas and has been working in Santa Fe already, and so this is a great opportunity to really put those out there. In fact, I think we've already seen increased enrollments in those high workforce area needs, correct?
We have, yes.
So where will this education center be?
Eventually, we're hoping by spring of 2013, if we can stay on track with the schedule, would be at the old College of Santa Fe campus, kind of in back of where the Oliver LaFarge Library is, and you'd be able to see it right across the street from the high school, which is one of my hopes, is that students at the high school see it and start thinking about higher education earlier, across the street,
right.
Maybe get a head start through dual credit and just keep going.
Now, you've already got students, high school students, in that master program at the community college, so you've got 14-year-olds taking college classes.
Well, you know, we have some students that are ready for that. It's certainly not the majority, but we do want to start building awareness in grade school and junior high school and getting them started sooner, because students who really apply themselves can actually get a 2-year degree before they ever leave high school through dual credit. And fast-tracking people through those programs, especially occupational training programs and career areas, we feel like students will use their time more effectively, save their family's money, and save the state money in the long run.
The tuition will be the same as going to community college, only for 4 years?
No, the tuition, when they're with us, is the same as our regular tuition. Then when they move into the other institutions, it will be their regular tuition.
So whatever Highlands is?
Yes.
And so help me with this, because I'm just beginning to learn about this. When somebody is in Santa Fe and they're getting a BA, which will be possible, looks like very soon, will it be from Highlands?
Yes, if they take it with Highlands. If they choose IAIA, their degree will be with IAIA. And if they choose UNM, their degree will be with them. And when you asked if we were going to be offering programs across the board, no, they really are targeted at high-need areas. And for those folks who may have specific interests or may want something else, what's really nice about IAIA's program is it is general studies and allows them to have a sort of liberal education background for whatever they might pursue later on.
Which is very important, as many of us liberal arts graduates will attest, because it helps you with everything else.
Yes.
So if a student gets enrolled in this program and they decide that they want to go to IAI, they will go down to the campus there, not to the higher education center, or how does it work?
Well, initially in the pilot, there may be some of the courses that would be offered on campus, but once the higher education center is constructed and open, that's where the classes will be offered.
Oh, okay.
And I think that's the the advantage of that program, is that the central location, and that's what we're hoping to do, is be available and accessible to students in that part of the city.
And with Highlands, the same thing.
That's right. Currently, we're located in facilities at the community college, and actually have been offering degree programs at the community college for quite a number of years. This is an expansion in terms of the number of programs that we're going to be offering, both at the bachelor's level and at the master's level. And then when the new facility is available, we, of course, with the other programs, will move over there.
So are there some new master's programs in the works beyond what Highlands already has?
We have about 5 master's programs that will be offered at the community college, and 7 or 8 bachelor's programs. Most of the newer additions to what we're offering are at the bachelor's level, but I think the master's level, there's some expansion of that as well.
What are some examples?
Well, in terms of the master's degrees, we're doing a number in education, curriculum and instruction, with a reading or a TESOL emphasis, special education, counseling, and educational leadership, and then our MBA program in business administration. At the bachelor's level, criminal justice is an expansion here, and various business administration programs in marketing, finance, management, accounting, social work, and then early childhood programs. All of those will be offered here. And we've seen quite an increase in enrollment already this fall compared to this time a year ago.
Very interesting. Now, is this conceived of as a program and as the Higher Education Center by and for the greater Santa Fe area? Or do you expect students to come from all over the state?
It really, our mission is to serve our local community as the community college. So that's why we did this program. It's allowable under a thing called the Higher Learning Center Act, which is state law and allows a public school or a county or a community college to form such a collaboration. And in our case, it was the community college. And our mission is to serve the local clientele. And so in our studies, we found people can save up to like $10,000 a year by staying in town and not having to pay for transportation and housing and childcare. And we know from serving our older students, many of whom have started families already, that that's really a critical aspect to even having the option of pursuing a bachelor's degree or beyond.
So how do people find out more about this?
Well, they call our main number, Dr. Tina Ledutsky-Taylor, who's the interim director for the program, at 428-1182. Or if they want to go directly to the institution they're interested in, I'll let you folks give that information.
They can call Highlands at...
you know, I don't know the phone number.
Oh, that's
right
fine. People can Google it, and they can do the same for IAIA.
For us, it'd be Kelly Mitchell at the Institute of American Indian Arts, 505-424-2311. Or we have an 800 number, and that's 1-800-804-6422.
And I actually do know the phone number.
Good.
It's 505, of course, 428-1445.
So you're going to build a whole new building. I mean, this is vacant land that you're talking about.
Correct. Our local taxpayers are very generous. They actually approved by about 60% approval rating for the bond issue that supports this project. And that was during the severe economic downturn. So that was yet more evidence that our community really needs and supports this project. And we will build about a 35,000 square foot building at that site that I mentioned. And we still have several more steps to go through, though. We're just now selecting, actually we did just select an architect for the project. But we need to...
Green, no doubt.
Yes, that was one of the absolute criteria. We're going for at least LEED Gold in all of our projects. And
well, and you have that building at the Santa Fe Community College now that is not only an energy-efficient building, but it's a tool for students to learn about solar and biomass and all these other things.
Correct. It's a high value for us, and I think it's shared by our partners. And fortunately, many more of the architects are very aware of this and becoming more proficient at meeting those requirements.
Is it going to be the same thing where the building is kind of its own laboratory?
You know, we had one of the architect presentations talking about an aspect like that, and I don't know yet. We haven't really started. The primary thing with building this building is that we work closely with our partners to see what their needs are, and it's not going to just be Santa Fe Community College saying what we're interested in, because we are working in a partnership. And, of course, the primary thing will be meeting the needs of the students, so we anticipate there'll be a common area for advisement and financial aid, counseling, and intake. And then we're hoping each partnering institution will have a way to maintain its own distinct identity, because we believe students going on to those institutions will want to think of themselves as a Highlands student or an IAIA or a UNM student.
How do you do that?
Signage,
design, hopefully some of the New Mexican design you see reflected, native design. If you go to our campus, you can certainly see that reflected in the architecture and design of our buildings. I would hope the Higher Education Center would have some of that reflected in their design as well, and the use of the buildings, space utilization, and so on.
Well, and I think students are pretty aware of the institution from which they're taking classes, and so I don't think identity is going to be a huge problem for any of the institutions who are participating at the center. We're all there to work together. That's really the important thing. The idea is to collaborate, to have articulation agreements in place so that students who may start at the community college have a very clear idea of what courses they need to take at the community college in preparation for transitioning into a program at Highlands or IAI, as the case may be. So I think the Higher Learning Center will be a great service for the people of the Santa Fe region. I don't worry too much about losing our identity in the process of being part of the larger whole.
I can imagine that there will be a student who says, okay, I live in Santa Fe, I want to take my classes, I want to have a degree from Highlands, but I don't want to go all the way up to Las Vegas all the time. But then the classes they want to take are up there.
Well, we actually offer a number of classes through ITV, interactive television, or through other distance delivery systems. We have centers that stretch from Raton in the northeast to Farmington in the northwest, plus here in Santa Fe, as I said earlier, for many years, Rio Rancho, Albuquerque. And so many of our courses originate from any one of those sites and can be serving students. So we can have half a dozen students in a class sitting in Las Vegas, and another four or five here in Santa Fe, and another four or five in Farmington, all participating in the same class with the same instructor simultaneously. Our offerings are going to be a mixture of in-person delivery as well as distance delivery formats.
What is the role of the University of New Mexico in all of this?
Thanks for asking. I was going to mention that all of UNM's programs are going to be online, so it's the same situation. They can bring students from wherever they are across the state. And what they will have at this point is a common point for students who live here to go in and see a real live person for advisement or intake. Mm-hmm.
And for our program as well, some of those courses are already offered online, but majority of the coursework will be offered on the campus of the community college initially, and then at the Higher Education Center. But that we'll see more and more of our coursework being offered online as well.
So are you going to have, in the new Higher Education Center building, kilns and drawing studios and textiles and all that?
Right now it's Indigenous Liberal Studies. We would like to offer something like creative writing in the future, but that remains to be seen what the needs are, as Dr. Ortego said earlier.
So what has to still happen? I mean, are you just about to break ground, or what still needs to happen for this Higher Education Center to be built and then to get students going through the programs?
Well, we are piloting so that we'll get the students started now and have a strong start to when we have a building. But we actually hope to break ground at the end of this year. And what still remains to be done is to have a hearing with the Higher Education Department to receive final approval for construction of the building. And we do have a letter in hand saying that we're an exemption from the moratorium for construction of any new higher education facilities. I believe they understand that we are not a new facility or a new program. We are really just a collaboration of existing programs, and that since this is locally funded and we're not requesting any further funds from the state, we were eligible to be an exemption. But we do have to go through that formality of presenting our capital projects plans to the Higher Education Department. And we're not sure when that will be scheduled, but we do hope it's soon, that, so that we can stay on schedule and break ground this fall. And then it does take a long time to build a building, so
yeah.
That's why spring 2013. And if
it's not that long. I mean, that's less than 2 years away.
Well, we're impatient to have this wonderful asset for our students.
Where did this whole idea come from? And I say this because, I mean, I know a student who's at the Santa Fe Community College, and he's dying to get a BA, but he can't go to Albuquerque. He can't go to Las Vegas. He can't go anywhere. He's pretty much stuck here with limited resources.
I think that's true of many, many, many students across the state of New Mexico. Higher education has changed so much over the last couple of decades. People, all of us, including me, frankly, we still tend to think as college students being 18 to 21, 22 years of age. That's really not the majority of the cases any longer. We have students that are working adults, they have families, they're very place-bound, and so the concept of having to relocate yourself, your family, or be commuting a substantial distance in order to attend classes just isn't realistic for many people. And so there really has been a shift in the nature of higher education, and that's why centers like this, expanding the opportunities for people in the Santa Fe region, is so important. In terms of Highlands, there are just a lot of people here that are not in a position to commute back and forth to Las Vegas every day. We are not going to offer all of our programs here, but we're trying to offer those that would be of service to the largest number of people. And so I think what we've seen in higher education, not just in New Mexico, but across the entire country, has been an expansion of the number of physical locations where it's possible to get at least some programs in order to serve the needs of rural, particularly rural communities, but also communities of state capital. And it's important to have four-year and graduate programs available to people here as well.
Now, IAIA also has quite an age range, don't they, in terms of the students?
Yes, we do. Our average age is around 28, so our students are older as well. And that's true for most tribal colleges across the nation. But the Higher Education Center gives us an opportunity to really reach out to the community and let them know that we are a community resource, and when they're looking at higher education, please consider the Institute of American Indian Arts. I've heard it said often that the Institute of American Indian Arts is one of Santa Fe's best-kept secrets, and we're trying to change this, and Dr. Ortego and the Higher Education Center are certainly helping in that regard.
And Mary Charlotte, in terms of the history, this idea sort of evolved out of that task force that was put together by the previous administration to look at what the city was going to do when the College of Santa Fe was closing. And there was discussion about having a branch of Highlands or investing, you know, to try to save the College of Santa Fe. And in the end, just through brainstorming and talking with each other, we think we found a win-win solution, which was to allow the private institution and try to support them in going forward with a focus on the arts, and to also make something for the first time that would be accessible and affordable for our local residents.
There's something that is a real problem in higher education these days, is especially private colleges have become so incredibly expensive that students are saddled with an almost unpayable debt when they get out, and there aren't necessarily the jobs waiting for them. This is a different model.
Well, and in terms of Highlands, we, according to U.S. News and World Report, a couple of months ago, they had a story that cited tuition and fees at Highlands as being the lowest in the country for a public four-year university. I think that turned out to be only institutions that had responded, but we're probably definitely at the lowest end of the cost in terms of tuition and fees, and we've very consciously, over a long period of time, tried very hard to keep our cost to students as low as we possibly can. So I think the transition from Santa Fe Community College, which is very reasonable tuition and fee costs, into Highlands University with our low tuition structure is a natural partnership that should serve students quite well.
How many students do you expect to go through this program once it's off and running?
I think in the early years we were projecting about 800 based on the research that we did. But I just wanted to add one other thing about the cost, which is it's just so much more affordable for folks. Also, because of the articulation agreements that we did, so often...
What are articulation
agreements? That's what I wanted to explain, is when students, historically, when students go through the first 2 years at Santa Fe Community College, there's supposed to be a requirement statewide that they go in basically with all of those core general education requirements and they don't have to repeat work at the university level. But in reality, without articulation agreements showing the map of what counts for what.
It's just basically what credits you get to transfer.
Then they often lose about a year's worth of education, so they have to double pay for that. And so with this model, we have everything fully articulated, then the students walk in the door in junior status. So you don't have that waste for the student or for the state.
Sheila Ortego is the president of Santa Fe Community College. Dr. Jim Fries is the president of New Mexico Highlands University. And Dr. Robert Martin is the president of IAIA, the Institute of American Indian Arts. Thank you all very much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news, then jazz.